Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
I'm Charles Pryor, and you're listening to New Books in British Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. People value loyalty. We prize it in our dogs. We loyally carry loyalty cards to claim discounts at our favorite stores and coffee shops. We follow sports teams, even when they lose. Loyalty is also deeply political. It is signified in oaths of office, in pledges of allegiance, and in the machinations of party politics. Loyalty, like justice, is taken to be an unalloyed good. As Don Corleone taught us, blood makes you related, loyalty makes you family. It's not surprising, then, that loyalty has deep and complex history in Anglophone political thought. The 17th century in Britain was a period in which political loyalties were shaped, tested, and sometimes fractured. Edward Valence is professor of history at the University of Roehampton. He has written widely on the politics of early modern Britain and on topics such as oaths and covenants, the revolution of 1688, and the radical history of Britain. In a range of essays, he's explored topics in political thought from the Renaissance to Thomas Paine. His new book, Loyalty, Memory, and Public Opinion in England, examines loyal addresses as mechanisms for the expression of public opinion and as links between the national and local contexts of politics. Ted Valence joins me from London. Welcome to the podcast, Ted.
Hi, Charles. Nice to speak to you.
So congratulations on the book. It deals with subscriptional culture, and you've been interested in this for a long time. It's a kind of a connecting thread in a lot of the stuff that you've written. So what is subscriptional culture, and what draws you to it as a way of approaching the political culture of this period?
Yes, well, subscriptional culture is, we're really talking about things which gain their authority, their importance, their value from the fact that people are being asked to subscribe to them, to add their names to them, to whether they sign them or whether they add their mark. So the kinds of things that we can think about within this, some of which you've already mentioned in your introduction, are oaths of loyalty, petitions, and also obviously the texts that are central to this book, which are loyal addresses. And you did mention I've been working on these for a long time. It's quite frightening now to think that it is probably about a quarter of a century, in fact, that I've been looking at these things from oaths of loyalty through to loyal addresses. And I suppose what's really fascinated me about them from the beginning of my research is the opportunity to think about how individuals engaged with politics in the early modern period and to sort of try where possible to sort of get a sense of what that meant for them, subscribing to an oath, subscribing to a petition, subscribing to a loyal address, what that act of subscription, that kind of individual political commitment meant. But also, of course, one of the things that's really important in the period that I'm talking about here and other scholars have talked about is not just individuals, but collections of people, large numbers of people, thousands of people subscribing to these kinds of texts, and what that kind of mass political activity meant. What was the significance of trying to get as many people as possible to subscribe to a particular text, an oath, an address, a petition. I mean, you mentioned the Article 50 petition there, and that the fact of the numbers of people subscribing to that is obviously something that was felt to be of particular importance right now. And that's something that's even more, in a sense, revolutionary in the period that we're talking about, where earlier in the early modern period, the idea of kind of opening up politics in this way would still have been very, very controversial. So those are the things that kind of fascinated me about it. What does it mean for the individuals concerned? What does it mean in a broader sense to have these kind of, you know, this broadening, if you like, of the political nation going on?
So in the period of early modern England specifically, there are some famous petitions or documents called petitions. One might be the Petition of Right. But what is a loyal address, and what distinguishes a loyal address from say, a petition?
So what really a loyal address is a declaration of loyalty, but from a corporate body rather than from an individual. So they're typically, in the period that I'm discussing, from official bodies. So from grand juries, from civic corporations, from counties, rather than being a kind of individual statement of loyalty, as might be through an oath of loyalty. But they share some similarities with petitions in that they, in the period that I'm talking about, can also be subscribed by very large numbers of individuals, by thousands of individuals. But unlike petitions, they're not ostensibly making requests for remedy of a grievance, although that can actually be part of it. They're offering the loyalty of that community. Standard phrases of things like offering lives and fortune to that community, to a monarch, or earlier in the period that I'm talking about, actually to the Lord Protector, to Oliver Cromwell, to Richard Cromwell. And they can also be offering congratulations or thanks. So it's often the case that addresses are being issued after, say, the accession of a new monarch, or after a military victory, or after the birth of a new royal heir, would be some kind of standard moments to issue a loyal address. And this is a form that's actually still with us today. So when Elizabeth II had her Diamond Jubilee, various what so-called privileged bodies in the UK issued loyal addresses to her. So it goes right into the modern period as well. This is still a kind of formal way in which congratulations are offered to the monarch.
So in terms of the modern ones are ceremonial or sort of ritualized, and I guess we'll come back to aspects of that later on. But in terms of it's the connection of loyal addresses to public or popular politics, you say that in the early modern period, we're really talking about the 17th and early 18th century here, you say that a critical political public emerged in this period. So what defines the public in this period, and what is its relation to that monster master Habermasian concept of the public sphere?
Yeah. Well, I think this is obviously, as you're acknowledging there in the question, been a massive subject of historical debate. Primarily, I'd say, sparked off by the translation of Habermas's work into English, as well as in a kind of broader sense by a kind of more homegrown, if you like, reaction to revisionist historiography, which was focusing, I think, quite a lot more on, if you like, political elites and rather more traditional sources for political history. And so those things have come together to provide this broader kind of examination of political culture and the idea of a political public. My book is engaging with that in really, I guess, critiquing both Habermas and some of the kind of historical work on an early modern public sphere, in that I think, you know, I'm doing quite a lot of the similar things that other historians have done in terms of critiquing Habermas by saying that it doesn't map with what we see on the ground, what we see in terms of the empirical evidence. So the idea that this is, you know, entirely located, or, you know, the critical moment is post 1688, that it's very much about this sort of Enlightenment culture, culture of coffee house sort of discussion and all the rest of it, that it's very much separated from the state. I go along with other historians such as Peter Lake and Steven Pinkus, who've, you know, criticized that picture and argue, for example, that we can see these kinds of things happening much earlier, that we can see it being situated in lots of different kinds of arenas, that we can also see, and I think this is really important in the case of Law Ledresse's, the state playing much more of an active role in this story of the development of a kind of sense of a political public. Where I guess I would be, I'm taking, I think, a different tack from those historians, is that I'm more aligned with Habermas, I think, in the sense that I think of this public as very much a kind of conceptual thing. And in some senses, I'm less rooted in the kind of sites, physical sites of political discussion. So coffee houses feature in the book, but they don't really feature in the same way as kind of generators of this public. There are other ways in which I think, and in some ways, the kind of separation of political discussion from particular physical sites is important. And this is one of the things I think that print does very importantly in this period, and in the case of Law Ledresse, is actually create this kind of separation from physical spaces and enable instead this more kind of conceptual awareness, for want of a better way of putting it, of public opinion. And in that sense, I've actually been influenced by other kind of modern communication theorists, in particular Michael Warner, and his work on the way in which kind of a sense of a public, it can really be generated by a kind of reflectiveness in public discussion, and in particular the importance of kind of timeliness and what he refers to as this kind of sort of temporally structured discussion. So the way in which, for example, emergent news culture is important in that respect, and also in a way the kind of cataloguing and compiling of printed material to kind of develop a history of that discussion is important, because what you start doing then is actually kind of mapping shifts in public mood, shifts in public opinion. So we're no longer just kind of in this kind of almost sort of perpetual now, which I think has been a focus of some of the discussion, is that sort of development of a sense of this sort of immediate moment. It's also about a developing an awareness of political behavior and political opinion over time, which is really critical in the case of loyalties, because it's not just about what you're prepared to say you want to, you know, who you want to kind of pledge your loyalty to at a particular moment, who you're promising your life and fortune to at a particular moment. It's how that pans out over the course of several years and decades. And of course, in the 17th century, this era of revolution, political instability, political crisis, it's really difficult for people to actually be kind of fixed in terms of their political loyalties. They're being pushed from pillar to post in a lot of ways. And then that leads to lots of very kind of interesting discussions about those kind of prior commitments and what they now mean.
So the source base then is, it's a sort of a social, I guess, would it be correct to say it's a sort of a social history of political communication?
Yeah, I think to some extent it is. And one of the things that I'm really keen to do, and it kind of follows on from my earlier work, but I think it's, you know, was really important in terms of understanding in a more fine-grained way who the public are that we're talking about, is to look at the manuscript evidence, as well as to look at the printed evidence that we have for addressing activity. I mean, we have thousands and thousands of these addresses in print through the pages of contemporary newsbooks, early newspapers. I mentioned compendia of these texts. They're also kind of broadsheet and pamphlet productions. It's harder, though, to find their manuscript equivalent, partly because these are, in some senses, ephemeral texts. And as with, I think, manuscript petitioning, particularly the more political petitions, surviving more in print than in manuscripts. And actually, you know, to go a little bit off topic for a moment, this is one of the things in some ways that hampers some of our research in some key areas of things like the Leveller movement. You know, we would really love to know who all these people were who were subscribing to the Leveller large petition in September 1648, or I would anyway. I don't know if anyone else would, but we don't always have access to that original material. So part of the research process was just trying to find as many manuscript records of these addresses as possible. So that was going through catalogues to find as many references as possible, going to those archives, looking at that material. And even within that material, a lot of what you find often in manuscript is not subscribed texts, but drafts of these addresses. And they're valuable in their own way because they tell us something about the process of developing these texts, of communities agreeing on a particular statement of loyalty. But they're not always giving us the access into, okay, who was prepared to sign up to this, or who did sign up to this particular statement of loyalty at a particular moment. So I'm then doing the work because those instances of subscription records surviving being quite limited, of drilling down into those records, of doing kind of further research into the biographies of those individuals, trying to pair it up with other kind of name-rich material. So I make use of Haast tax records, taxation records in the book that give us a sense both of the kind of social status of these individuals, where we can possible their religious and political background. Also, they're the geography of subscription as well, so which is one of the things that the tax records give us some evidence of. And that gives us a sense, too, of how actually representative these documents are. So one of the things that I look at in real depth within the book is the Leicestershire address to Richard Cromwell in 1658. And one of the things that's interesting, there are lots of things that's interesting about that, but one of the things that's interesting is that we can see that this is not an address that actually has kind of broad coverage across the county. There are very obvious hot and cold spots across the county, areas where there are kind of virtually no subscriptions and areas where we get lots and lots of subscriptions to these texts. And that might be suggesting all sorts of things about kind of political influence in certain areas as opposed to others. Maybe also actually to do with a religious geography of the county as well, because some of the areas where we see the least number, the fewest subscriptions are in areas where we know that there was significant kind of Baptist strength as well, and perhaps connections there between kind of Baptist movement and Commonwealthsmen in the late 1650s may be coming into play as well. So it lets us kind of drill down into the geography of loyalty, and also drill down into, as you were mentioning, the kind of social history aspect of this. How broad socially is this subscriptional culture? And the evidence from the Leicestershire address is that it really is really pretty broad, because there are people here who are not appearing in things like taxation records, and that suggests that they probably, you know, below the level to be rated for things like the Haast tax. One other kind of really obvious and important absence from these records in virtually all the cases, with one possible exception that I mentioned in the book, is women, and that they really don't appear in these manuscript records of subscription, which is a contrast to other subscriptional texts, in particular petitions, but also oaths of loyalty. And so that's quite distinctive there, that it, on addresses, they don't seem to be present. And I think that...
Why do you think that is?
Sorry. No, I was going to... You've asked me the question. I was going to go on and say that I think this is to do with it as a corporate representation of the community, and the less about individual commitment and testing individual commitment. Those scholars who've worked on, for example, oaths of loyalty, and I think this comes across best in John Walter's recent work on the protestation, particularly during the Civil War, where this is part of the process of mobilization. John Walter thinks, and I really agree with this take, that the reason why we're finding women on protestation returns 1641 to 1642 is because Parliament actually does want to mobilize as many people as possible, whether they're women or men, to provide material support for the parliamentarian cause. Now, they're not anticipating that women are going to fight, but women could be providing money and other kinds of material support to the parliamentarian cause, and they want to get them on board. It's the same thing with petitioning. It's about mobilizing individuals for the cause. And these kinds of texts are being less structured by that kind of, the sort of the corporate officialdom of the corporation, the county bench, and so on. So I think in contrast with addresses, the idea is more that the rest of the community is kind of being virtually represented by these texts. And that particularly becomes the case when we move into the Restoration period and we see subscription becoming much more socially exclusive as well, that we see it much more, particularly in the immediate Restoration period, as being an activity in which the elite, both the elite in terms of officialdom, but the social elite, gentlemen, the aristocracy, are those who are predominantly subscribing to these texts. That particularly comes through in their printed versions, where a lot of these immediate post-restoration addresses actually structure the subscription in a social hierarchy. So we get the aristocracy at the top of the subscription list, then we get the esquires, then the gentlemen, and so on. That's not actually how they appear in the manuscript versions, which are all higgledy-piggledy. So it's quite interesting to see the way in which, when they were put into print, they very much wanted to kind of show that hierarchy in the printed version.
That's brilliant. The methodological acuteness of the book, it will be obvious to anybody that reads it. You've done extremely well with very difficult sources. Yeah, really, really well. So we talked about approach, we've talked about method, we've talked about sources. Let's turn to context. We've mentioned Richard Cromwell, we've mentioned the Restoration, and we do hopefully there are people in the United States who are listening to us who maybe have some grasp of this history, but maybe not. So let's talk about context. The first context that I want to sort of zero in on is the aftermath of the English Civil War, as we will conventionally call it. We could devote an entire podcast to what we could call that conflict, but we'll just call it the Civil War. And after the execution of the king, you have the emergence of a sort of a non-royal mini-dynasty headed by Oliver Cromwell. And this is the point where you really see the emergence of these addresses as a thing. So why is the 1650s such a generative decade for these things?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. For me, it's part of a process which other historians, Jason Peace is a key one here, have identified, of the regime in the 1650s really learning how to manage, if you like, its news culture and manage public opinion. So one of the things that have been commented on massively about the 1640s is this kind of explosion of popular political culture and popular political forms. So mass petitioning, pamphlet publication and cheap print publication going through the roof in terms of the number of titles, a kind of almost a sort of free-for-all, feeling like a free-for-all in terms of printed discussion, controversy. Although the reality is that through the 1640s, the parliamentarian regime is trying to put controls back on the press. And as the kind of political situation stabilizes somewhat over the 1650s, we see more and more of that kind of control being put into place. So one example of that is particularly as we move into the era of the Protectorate. So with Oliver Cromwell being the head of state, you see print culture narrowing, newsprint culture narrowing to these kind of state-controlled news books, French language equivalent Nouvel Ordinaire de Londres, and its English language equivalent Mercurius Politicus. So the state is trying to kind of control what kind of news is being put out there, to put it crudely. And I think that addresses form part of this project of trying to kind of control public opinion. So if we think about mass petitioning as kind of the more critical and less controlled sort of, you know, cousin of addressing. Addressing is it's more kind of well-behaved and kind of centrally managed relative. This is something that is initially driven by the accession of Oliver Cromwell to the protectoral title. And so we first really start to see these texts emerging as a way of legitimizing this title of Lord Protector and of trying to show public support for his accession, for his elevation rather, to that title. And that's something that then continues in a really marked fashion with the succession of his son Richard Cromwell to the protectoral title in 1658. And so we see many, many addresses, both from the army and from English towns and counties, and actually outside of England as well, from English colonies, from Scotland, from Ireland, coming forward as well to Richard Cromwell.
The title of the protector, though, I mean, there had been protectorships of a sort in the 16th century during minority reigns. Why was the concept of a protectorate under Cromwell something that needed to be given the stamp of legitimacy?
It's for reasons that on the one side, this is not a kind of protector Somerset as you kind of 16th century examples where we are, you know, in a position that there is a hereditary monarch who is in their minority, who's too young to rule on their own, who is going to be kind of, you know, looked after until they reach their majority, and then they're going to rule. We're in a situation where, you know, monarchy has officially been abolished. The Stuarts are in exile. And so there isn't really anyone else except perhaps King Jesus, which, you know, a lot of the important figures in this period in 1650s think that the second coming of Jesus Christ is imminent. And if they're preparing for any king to return, it might be Jesus Christ. But they're not. It's not that kind of temporary arrangement here that we're talking about, where there already is, if you like, a legitimate hereditary monarch who is just being looked after until they reach their majority. On the other side, you have got people who nonetheless see this title of Lord Protector as too much like the monarchy that has been abolished, as too much of a return to those previous ways of governing, which for them have been shown to be too likely to dissolve into tyranny, which in any case are inimical to what they would see as the kind of roots of political power in the people, and for some of them also is actually a block. Those who do have this kind of millenarian vision is a block to the return of Jesus Christ and his saints to rule. And so you're kind of caught between these kind of royalist, republican, radical Puritan views of authority here. And so what Cromwellians are trying to do is to try and establish the authority of this different position that is neither, you know, that kind of explicitly kind of republican or millenarian kind of settlement, or, you know, very obviously a kind of, you know, a royal monarchical kind of settlement. But what we actually see in 1658, when Richard Cromwell succeeds, is something that is very like actually a royal succession crisis, because there's all sorts of debates that are going on about whether Oliver actually did nominate him as his successor, whether actually there are other people who might be better to occupy this position of Lord Protector. So, you know, other members of the Protectoral Council like Charles Fleetwood are being mentioned. People who have more of a kind of military background, military connections are being discussed. And of course, there are also people who are retaining their loyalty to the Stuart dynasty and think that this is also, you know, potentially the moment for the return of that, just as there are people who are thinking about this is a moment where a Republican settlement might be returned to, one that is explicitly Republican, rather than what they might see as this kind of, you know, a mishmash of monarchy and republic. And so the addressing campaigns to Richard Cromwell pay an enormous part in that debate. And one of the things that I found really interesting is the way in which these texts that are supposed to be and sometimes dismissed as kind of bland expressions of sycophancy, of loyalty to authority, in fact, are really critical and making all sorts of interesting statements about their view of political authority at this moment in time. A debate which then continues on into Richard's only kind of parliament and into the discussion that goes on there about his title as well.
So there's a lot of the 1650s, it's anything goes. There's a lot of political alternatives, and the state could have taken any number of directions. It could have remained a republic. It could have become almost a theocracy. But they opted for stability, which is one of the watchwords of British politics, or it used to be. So the monarchy comes back in 1660. And it's Charles II, and the politics of religion flares up. And when his heir, or his legitimate heir, or I'm digging myself a hole here. Anyway, when the Duke of York, his brother, is primed for the succession, there's opposition to him, and this sets off a train of events that leads to the Revolution of 1688, what is sometimes called the Glorious Revolution. How do addresses function through the very, very turbulent decades of the 1660s, 70s, and 80s?
Yeah, so one thing that's really interesting if we look at the earlier period is that although we might see what happens in 1658, 1659 with Richard Cromwell as evidence that, you know, even if addresses are interesting vehicles for looking at how different communities view political authority, they're not successful in terms of keeping Richard in power. I mean, he does, you know, after a matter of months, he's basically kicked out by the army. So we could see this as, you know, that they're not really kind of substantial enough in that regard. But one of the interesting things, and this is one of the things, again, that I found from drilling down into these Cromwellian addresses, is the way in which they help communities build kind of political coalitions behind particular individuals or particular policies. And I think that's one of the things you can see happening over the course of the late 1650s leading up to the Restoration. It's one of the things that Blair Worden's written about as well recently in relation to petitions, declarations, addresses in support of a free parliament. So a lot of the things that are leading up to Charles II being restored are interlinked with the subscriptional texts, petitions, addresses, declarations, with different, quite disparate groups, you know, moderate parliamentarians, moderate royalists coming together to try, you know, you mentioned stability, to try and sort of work towards settlements that they think will achieve greater political stability. And finally, that seems to be restoring the Stuart dynasty. One of the things that then happens, though, which I've already mentioned, is that we see a move away in the early years of the Restoration from the kind of mass addressing activity, thousands of people subscribing that you see in the Cromwellian era, It's not, I would say, such a dramatic shift, because even those Cromwellian addresses had tended to emphasize the way in which they came from authoritative bodies. So the way in which they came from corporations, counties, and so forth, rather than coming from just sort of, ad hoc collections of the so-called, you know, supporters well affected or whatever. But there is a kind of drawing back from the popular. Now, what we see that happens in the later restoration period in the 1670s and 1680s is that you get the return of popular subscriptional activity. And this is triggered by this succession crisis, this exclusion crisis, as it's known, over James, Duke of York's succession, because he is a Catholic and there's a lot of anxiety in a Protestant nation about having a Catholic successor, with all of the kind of memories of Mary Tudor's reign and all of the kind of anxiety about popery that have been stoked up over the century or so since then. And so there's really kind of frenetic kind of subscription activity that's going on in the late 1670s, right through the 1680s. Mass petitioning activity, mainly being orchestrated by the kind of the early Whig Party, but also on the kind of opposing side, mass addressing activity in support of the line of succession, in support of James succeeding to the throne. And that addressing activity in particular continues all the way through the 1680s. The 1680s is the most frenetic period of addressing activity. We get thousands and thousands of these texts being produced in support of, for example, the dissolution of Parliament in 1681 and Charles II's stated reasons for doing that, expressing relief at the fact that Charles II and his brother haven't been killed as a result of Whig plotting and the Rye House plot in 1683, at James's accession to the crown in 1685, and also in support of James's policies in favor of religious toleration in the later 1680s. And that is really significant, because one of the things that I'm arguing happens over the 1680s especially is that that memory of addressing activity has its own impact upon politics and upon James's freedom of action in particular. One of the things that Charles and his supporters is doing in the early 1680s is he's really ramping up through these addresses a kind of rhetoric about how the Whigs and their dissenting allies are basically the same people as the Puritans and parliamentarians of the 1640s and 1650s, and they want to do the same thing. You know, they don't just want to keep out a popish successor. They want to get rid of monarchy altogether. They want to get rid of the Church of England. They basically want a kind of anarchistic, Puritan Commonwealth free for all. Now, there's some recent historical work which might say there's actually a germ of truth in some of that, but it's obviously an exaggeration also to a considerable degree. But one of the things that I think that rhetoric does is that because it's coming forward through these kinds of texts of addresses, which are rehearsing these kinds of histories of the Civil War and tying the Whig Party to that history and tying dissent to that history, is that it then makes it very difficult for James and his supporters to, if you like, suddenly change the tone of debate in their addresses and say, oh, actually, you know, toleration is good. We want to bring dissenters and Catholics into public life. This is, you know, to the benefit of the state, all the rest of it, because they've been saying for the preceding half of the decade that all these people were terrible. They were anathema, fanatics, you know, king killers, all the rest of it. So I think that then puts all sorts of constraints on, you know, the authority of those later addresses and how credible they seem. And one of the things that's said about them is that they are unrepresentative, that they're kind of manufactured, that they're not really the product of official bodies, official corporate bodies, but they're really, you know, the concoctions of these sort of small numbers of dissenters or small numbers of Catholics and dissenters who are trying to purport to present the opinion of a certain county or a certain town. So I think that memory the mnemonic aspect, I put it, of these texts is actually really, really important. It's one of the ways in which I really see them contributing to the development of public opinion. There's just awareness of that. Your community said something quite different only a matter of years ago. And why have you suddenly made this kind of change, dramatic change in your sort of public statement of loyalty? I think that aspect of it is really important.
One of the striking things about the 17th century is the way that in some sense the political impulses, the sources of conflict, are things that are very, very deeply rooted in English history. Questions about succession, questions about religion, questions about faction, or worries about radicalism. But at the same time, and this book sort of shows that there are the emergence of things that we would call modern, and I'd put that in inverted commas. And one of them is the emergence, you've mentioned the Whig Party and the exclusion crisis, and is the emergence of political parties as things that had to be contended with. They were new. An opposition was new. A prime minister, as they emerged, was new. And addresses in this context become, you describe them as becoming adversarial. Adversarial in what sense?
So I think if we were looking at the period we've just been talking about, in the 1680s, there's certainly an adversarial element there. Obviously, we have these kinds of petitioning and then counter-addressing campaigns and so forth. But they are less the property of particular political movements in that way, particularly addressing. So addressing, I think, remains in the earlier period a kind of a vehicle which is largely or campaigns and which are largely being initiated by the centre. And there are all sorts of interesting responses to that, but it's the monarchy, it's the court that is kind of prompting these campaigns. What I think happens in the post-revolutionary period is we see these political groupings, Whig and Tory, making use of addresses as part of their own kind of party political campaigning machinery. And it becomes very much, and this is something that Martin Eitz has also written a lot about, becomes part of the process of electioneering in what becomes then a very feverish period of elections, happening very, very frequently over the course of the 1690s, early 1700s. And addresses are used as part of this process of trying to convince the voting public to go for your party rather than the other party at the polls, which itself was a novelty. If we're looking in the earlier period, a lot more of these so-called elections are actually selections. There's not really any kind of contestation going on. That's not what's happening in the 1690s and 1700s. And addresses are playing, a key part in actually convincing or trying to convince voters or move voters to choose a particular kind of party or particular MP. So I think that's really important sort of change there. One of the other things that, again, this is something that Martin Eitz has commented on, is the role that they're kind of playing in terms of political discourse and political language. And one of the arguments that's made both by contemporaries and I think picked up by Knights is that all of this kind of frenetic addressing activity is also leading to all sorts of anxieties about truthfulness in political discussion, which obviously has all sorts of contemporary resonances for us now.
Fake news,
fake addresses. Well, there's a lot of fake addresses kind of being or being alleged or being purported to be produced. And so you get people producing kind of figure, writers like Benjamin Hoadley producing, if you like, sort of glossaries for people of how, what does this word actually mean? When somebody says this, what are they actually talking about? How do you parse these kinds of political texts? And for some people, and Daniel Defoe is probably at the extreme of this, they move to a position where they're saying, well, we've got to really, we need to sort of almost put a lid on this activity because it's getting to the point where nobody really knows what anyone means anymore. It's really kind of, we can't trust what anyone is saying in their political discussion anymore. You know, do they really mean 350 million for the NHS? No, I'm sorry. you know, they've got those kind of anxieties about sort of political claims and political terms losing any kind of mooring in reality. Now, I think this is one area where I though think that, again, we come back to the importance of the memory of earlier activity in here actually providing some kind of assurance. Because one of the other interesting things that this sort of frenetic partisan activity does is it actually generates this memory of what different groupings are doing. And it's something that's reflected in print culture as well. So one of the things that I've mentioned already that we see happening is the generation of these kinds of collections or compendia of addresses. And one of the interesting things that they are doing is actually marking out different kinds of texts as belonging to different kinds of parties. So you'll see, for example, the printer John Morphew, in his collections, he actually gives them different typefaces. You know, some of them regular types, some of them are Gothic, and that represents different groupings, you know, low church, high church, Whig, Tory, and so on. Now, what that does for me, that means is actually providing a means of navigating the political landscape, because you're saying, look, these are these guys, these are these other guys, here's what they think, here's what they think, here's what they did 5 years ago, here's what they're doing now. You know, can we trust them? Can we not trust them? But the other thing that I think these collections are doing is, of course, they're also spinning these texts, because, again, when we drill down into them, they're not nearly as partisan as they sometimes seem. And what a lot of communities are actually trying to do is just hedge their bets, because there's a risk in not addressing at all, because you could be seen to be, you know, if, for example, you're supposed to be congratulating the monarch on their general's military victory and you don't send an address, then you might be being seen to be a little bit, you know, lagging in the the loyalty of your own community, no matter that this addressing campaign is being spun in a particular kind of political way. You know, pro-Whig, pro-Tory, whatever it is. So a lot of communities are actually trying to sort of occupy a middle path. But what these compilers and commentators on addressing are doing is putting this kind of partisan gloss on it, which is interesting in its own respect, because, again, it's about this sort of, you know, conjuring up public opinion and the shifts in public opinion over time, which I think is really, really interesting. And even those figures like Defoe, in particular, who seem to be suggesting this has all got too much and nobody knows where they stand anymore. Again, when you drill down into what they're saying, it's actually, again, a kind of exercise in opinion management. What they really want to say is these addresses are not okay, but these ones are okay. You know, these kinds of subscriptional texts are the proper ones, and these ones are the ones that we ought to discount because they're illegitimate. Again, I think contemporary resonances, you know, you mentioned the Article 50 petition and, you know, the rejection of it, I think, was very much of the kind of this is not an appropriate thing to do, because we've actually already had another legitimate kind of exercise in canvassing public opinion, which was the referendum. And we don't want to pay attention to other kinds of ways of conveying public opinion, because we've already had that legitimate you know, way of listening to the public, and that's happened and that's gone. So it's, you know, there's lots of really interesting things going on here which are very much connected to the development of you know, the political the party system in the 1690s, 1700s.
Sure. And the sort of the other aspects that come out in the final chapters of the book, you turn to consider some stuff and topics that I think also have people will recognize them in the current political context. I mean, there's a lot to look at, but you consider the performance of loyalty, which is in some sense about access. And the language of loyalty, which is something that's sort of conditioned by recent development in the history of emotions. What do these things tell us about how loyalty functioned and evolved towards the end of the period that the book is concerned with?
Yeah, so I think, well, one thing is a sort of methodological point, which is that I've been interested for quite a long time in the non-verbal aspects of politics and the way in which politics is done, you know, not just through texts, whether manuscript or printed, but through through speech, through gesture, through performance. And I think addressing activity has to be understood in all of those kinds of dimensions, because for communities, one of the really, really important things that they're doing by producing these addresses, and you mentioned access, is they are getting access to the political elite. They are getting access to the monarch, to the Lord Protector in the earlier period. And they're using these statements of loyalty as a way, you know, to secure the kinds of things that they need. And so one of the examples that I go into quite a bit of detail about in the book is you know, this relatively small minor trade corporation, the Cutlers of Hallamshire, and they produced this loyal address to Charles II and presented at court. And they're doing this really as part of their campaign to secure a tax exemption. They basically don't want to be taxed on the hearths that they use in their forges. They've been trying lots of other things, but one of the things they're doing is they're going through this kind of political performance as a way to gain access at court and influence at court. So it's a lobbying strategy, but it's also, again, also about, you know, what is the proper expression of loyalty. And that's not just about the words that you use. It's the way in which you perform and you present these texts. So, you know, you need to have the right people accompanying these texts. You can't just have the hoi polloi coming to court to present your address. You need to have the great and good of your community. If it is a text coming from a corporation, it needs to clearly be coming from that corporation in terms of the personnel who are delivering it. You know, that's also about showing that this text is genuine, it's authoritative. So the performance is really important in that respect as well. So those aspects are really interesting for me. And there's also interesting things in terms of change over time with that as well. It's one of the things where I think that James II's practices again are jarring with the earlier practices of his brother. So Charles is increasingly prescriptive about who can come to court and present an address. It should be the nobility and the gentry. And when James starts to pursue this policy of toleration, it also means that he's basically admitting kind of people of lower status to come present these addresses at court as well. And I think that is another thing that's starting to kind of set alarm bells ringing, if you like. Also the way in which he receives addresses. And there's one particular example I use in the book where he's very, very rude to some Baptists who address him. And I think that's also showing a kind of clumsier, if you like, approach to the kind of ritual politics or the gestural politics of loyalty as well. The language side of things is really interesting. It's one of the things that I think you mentioned, history of emotions, and that's important to me as well. I think in your intro, you talked about the way in which loyalty is very much a kind of emotional value. It's something that philosophers working on loyalty have stressed a great deal. And I think that's a different way of thinking about political affiliation and the way in which we quite often talk about political affiliation in terms of a sort of, you know, a more legally defined sense of obligation. This is about feelings. This is about, you know, feelings of gratitude, feelings of love, feelings of thankfulness, all being expressed, you know, from the people to the monarch and being reciprocated. That reciprocal aspect of it as well is very important too. And that, you know, trying to sort of trace how that emotional language changes over time, I think it is important for understanding how loyalty changes over the period that I'm talking about. So I did some analysis using some software, corpus analysis software, in these compendia of addresses. And what is interesting is that though the language remains very much emotional, it does become to a certain extent depersonalized after 1688. So we're still talking about emotional loyalty, but it's emotional loyalty to things like the Constitution or to ideals like liberty rather than to a particular royal dynasty. And so that's, you know, it's really interesting to kind of look at those things using those kinds of techniques as well.
Fascinating. I've been talking to Ted Valance, who's professor of history at the University of Roehampton. The book is called Loyalty, Memory, and Public Opinion in England. It's published by the University of Manchester Press, and I recommend it to anyone who is boggled and depressed by the politics of the Twitter sphere. Ted, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you, Charles. Cheers. We'll be right back.